The pattern that we follow, many of you have done this with us. I was trying to remember when we first started this particular way of celebrating the gurus. I know we originally started it around July 25th, which is said to be the day that Babaji appeared to Master and gave him approval to come to America. I believe I have that correct. Anyway, it's celebrated as Babaji Day, since there's no birthday or Mahasamadhi for Babaji. And then gradually we shifted over to scheduling it on the closest Saturday to the full moon in July. Full moon in July in the tradition of India is Guru Purnima. Purnima means the full moon, I believe. And in any case, it's considered to be the most sacred day of the whole Indian calendar, is the day that you give reverence to your guru. So as it happens, the full moon was yesterday, so we're very, very close right now. And this also is an astrologically interesting moon because of Mars and so on and so on, all of which lends a kind of divine power to what we're going to do. Our program is very simple, and yet somehow or another, every year we've done this for, I think it's been more than 20 years. I've been trying to remember when we started. We have, as you can see, we have shrines. Now we have permanent shrines to all the masters. Before, we used to have to create one or two or three. And what we do is we sing. This first shrine, we'll do a little more music at the very beginning. But then the pattern we'll follow will be all speak about that master. We'll have a chant. Then we'll have one of a solo, somebody singing. Then we'll meditate about 10 minutes. And then afterwards, we'll have lit candles. I guess we have two tables of lit candles. And everybody will then go and get a lit candle and place it on the shrine as your own personal offering of your own inner light into the master, in whatever way moves you, inspired by the music and inspired by what's been said. I will encourage you, when we put our candles here, do not be Western. Do not form one long single line, or else we'll never get through it. Okay? Just crowd in. Master wants to see you. He doesn't care. And just find any place in relation to the shrine where you feel. You can take your time once you're in there, but don't be orderly, or otherwise it takes too long. Please, as much as possible, keep silence from when we begin to when we finish. In fact, you'll find long after we finish, because it just helps everyone to remain inward. If you need to speak to someone, please do it very softly. If it needs to be a longer conversation, please step away from the central area. We start when the sun is up. We end when the moon is up. We start with almost no candles lit. We end with hundreds of candles lit. And it's a pilgrimage journey to a surprising extent, considering how little actual geography we traverse. But it happens entirely because of the magnetism of the individual devotees. I believe the masters really like this night. They seem to come pretty steadily to be with us. Even at first, when I'm not sure they're going to be here, then they seem to arrive. If any of you prefer to sit on the ground and didn't bring anything, I just thought of that when I saw Stephen. Just to the left of this building, there's a little, what looks like a garden shed, which leads into our temple. There's kneeling benches outside, and there's pillows inside, if you end up preferring that way of sitting. Do we have to move our chairs? When we go, people should move their own chairs? Okay, so when Babaji moves around in the Himalayas, sometimes he says, Dera Danda Utau, which means pick up your staff and walk. I don't know what the word is for chair. But after you've made your offering, when we go to the next shrine, if everybody just picks up one chair and carries it quietly, it works very nicely and it's simple for everyone. All right, I don't think, have I forgotten anything that's important that needs to be said? Please come. Make yourselves comfortable. All right. So let's begin with a prayer. Because we repeat this prayer very often, there's a temptation to forget what we're saying and kind of come to consciousness when the original part starts. but especially tonight, we are really invoking the presence of the Masters. We have to realize that our relationship with God and Gurus is exactly that. It's a relationship. And the way we express ourselves is what activates the response, the receptivity. So when we recite the litany of the Gurus, feel that each one is a distinct ray of the divine that is going to enter into each one of us individually insofar as we are able to lift our hearts and open them to receive Him. So as we pray, let this be the beginning of attuning ourselves by saying the names. In the name of each Master inherently is the vibration of the divine that he represents, or the aspect of God that is represented. So in that spirit, let's pray. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to attune ourselves to your divine presence. Strengthen our devotion, our courage, our purity of heart, that we may escape from the illusion of this world into the lasting reality of your omnipresence. We are your children. Receive us in light. Om. Peace. Amen. Now we'll have a little bit of music.
I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help. My help cometh from the Lord, who made the heavens and the earth. He will not suffer thy foot to be moved. He that keepeth thee will not slumber. Behold, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is thy keeper. The Lord is thy shade upon thy right hand. The sun shall not smite thee by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord shall preserve thee from all evil. He shall preserve thy soul. The Lord shall preserve thy God. coming in from this time forth. And even forevermore.
Please join us in this song called Cloisters.
Long I've called you my Lord. Long I've called you. Many years I have longed for your side. Bathe the darkness with tears of devotion. Offered candles in prayer to your light. How much longer, friend, must I cry your name? I am yours, ever yours. Will you come? Long I've called you my Lord. Long I've called you. Many years I have longed for your sight. Bathe the darkness with tears of devotion. Offered candles in prayer to your light. How much longer, friend, must I cry your name? I am yours, ever yours. Will you come?
We want to start, we go through the masters. I suppose chronological is sort of a funny word when you're dealing with realities that transcend time and space. So we'll go through in the sequence that we tend to think about them, in the same way that we pray to the masters, Jesus, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Sri Yukteswar, Paramhansa Yogananda, and his disciple, of course, Swamiji, who's been our guiding spirit all the way through. It's very interesting, the evolution of one's consciousness on the spiritual path, from when one is first introduced to these ideas, and then gradually over time, as a new reality begins to set in. I was raised Jewish, and Jews are not, as a rule, generally very fond of Jesus. And in fact, pretty much you can be just about anything as a Jew except a follower of Jesus. You can be a Buddhist, you can be a yogi, you can be all kinds of things. But there is this deeply ingrained prejudice, which is paradoxical, of course, because Jesus was a Jewish rabbi and all his followers were Jews, and it never stopped being Judaism until long after Jesus had died. It was Judaism start to finish. But history takes over and weird things happen. Okay? And at the same time, those who are dedicated to Jesus now get very upset because Jesus has to share the altar with Yogananda and Babaji. And so pretty much in the Western tradition, whichever side you approach it, it's a big no-no. And if you come from India, at least until very recently, the Christian missionaries had such a profound disregard for the tradition of India that Jesus became associated with everything that India needed to expel in order to have its own appropriate destiny. So poor Jesus has had to bear the brunt of all of this. So one way or another, when we come back into the path of self-realization, really either from the West or from the East, let's look at it in the positive way. We get to throw away everything we know, and we get to just start over from truth as Yogananda expressed it. As I'll talk more as this evening progresses, Master brought a new dispensation. When Swamiji asked him if what he brought to America was a new religion, he said, no, but it is a new expression. And that phrase has meaning in an historical sense, or in the sense of reading religious history or cultural history. But it's much more important even than that, although that plays a role, for us to realize that self-realization is a new expression of our own consciousness. Because our consciousness is infinite and ageless and as old as anything, as time itself. We inhabit these bodies for a short period of time. We identify with these egos and all its conditions, and therefore we think time itself and age itself is short, but that's not true. We belong to infinity, and we are part of infinity. Very difficult for the mind to comprehend. And so what we have to realize on the path of self-realization is that this is not a new religion in the sense that we've invented something that's never been thought of before, but it's a new expression of who we are. And each one of these masters brings to us, you might say, a facet of the diamond. And even though there are countless masters and avatars, even in the realm of remembered history, what to speak of long since forgotten incarnations of God, nonetheless, our particular spiritual path has been associated with a certain family, of which Jesus is a prominent character. In fact, the beginning character. Every week in the Festival of Light, Swami created the Festival of Light, which we do as our Sunday ritual, so that every single week, the essential characteristics of this spiritual path, we would get the opportunity to immerse ourselves in them in such a way that it would gradually sink into the subconscious and become not merely something we heard and remembered, but something that we become. And in the Festival of Light, it says, Jesus appeared to the great master Babaji. Now, when you're dealing with scripture, and the Festival of Light is definitely scripture, the vibrations of truth are created in every phrase, are inherent in every phrase. And the scriptural writing is only secondarily for the ideas it represents. Its primary purpose is to carry the vibrations. So the Festival of Light makes the statement, Jesus appeared to the great master Babaji. And you really just start there, because we're dealing with East and West, we're dealing with inner and outer realities, we're dealing with spiritual truth versus a materialistic technological approach, but all of it is symbolic of all the different sides of ourself that we're not even so much trying to reconcile as to abandon and simply forget. Swami says, interestingly, when you call yoga union, it implies that there's two different things to be reconciled. He said, in fact, there's only one reality. And union, yoga in the sense of union, means we give up our resistance to that which is and simply allow ourselves to be that which we have always been. So when Jesus appears to the great master Babaji, we start by realizing that everything that society as a whole accepts as true is not. It's just as simple as that. The Bhagavad Gita says, what is day to the worldly man is night to the yogi. What is night to the yogi is day to the worldly man. we think in terms of short spans of time and our little identity with this world. But our souls live on an entirely different plane. And everything that seems so real and so vital now is really just a play of light and shade. And Jesus appears to the great master Babaji and says, you know, we need to do something about the West and by extension about the East. In the autobiography of a yogi, Master makes this statement just so simply, Babaji and Jesus together have planned the salvation of this age. And they're conscious of all of the conflicting energies which these days seem to be accelerating, and we're seeing them all over the planet at all times right now. But Jesus and Babaji together, one with a body and one without a body, is how Master describes it, have planned the salvation of this age. And these masters appear in a physical body, with the exception of Babaji, only for a period of time. But once a master's consciousness exists anywhere in the ether, it remains unchanged forever. So we have this extraordinary example of Jesus, who was such a combination of extreme sweetness and extreme kindness and embracing all. And you see it in the way that he humbly and selflessly, utterly sacrificed his life in order to set an example of death transcendence and fear transcendence and time transcendence and the power to simply stand in truth. Master remarks about Jesus, he said, even without speaking, Jesus presented a tremendous challenge to all who are around him. And among the Jewish people that Jesus was called to serve, on one hand were his dedicated disciples, and on the other hand were those who also called themselves Jews, but were in fact a corrupt priesthood whose dedication was to power and money. And on the other side, you had the mystical tradition in the Essene community where Jesus was born. And Jesus was born for those disciples, and then he was born to stand in truth when all of that power and misunderstanding simply, you know, overwhelmed him and took his life away. And the extraordinary life story of Jesus, which we play out again and again and again, is simply that, which is truth against fear, courage against fear, self-sacrifice against selfishness, and truth against delusion. And what each of these masters also give us, the way Swami described it, the same power, but just coming through a slightly different lens. And because all five of these masters govern our lives, each one of us at different moments of our life can find that vibration of spirit that we're going to need. You know, we are moving, we have been living for a while, and it appears as though we're going to be moving into more tumultuous times. When you move into tumultuous times, to be able to have the vibration in the ether of Jesus' courage in the face of assault, it's a very powerful picture for us to take into ourselves. And it's not the picture of the ignominious apparent ending of his life or the suffering that he seemingly had to endure. The entire message of the life of Jesus begins with the resurrection and is proven by the life-transforming power that he was able to give to his disciples that enabled them to carry on in the face of all obstacles. And yes, in the life of Jesus, even in the life of his disciples, that truth against falseness and that courage in the face of threat was a theme all the way through. We would like it not to be. But in fact it was. His disciples too had to face very hard times, his immediate disciples, most of whom were hounded out of their comfortable homes, and many of them met very difficult ends from a human point of view, execution or death in other ways. The movement went underground for a while, and then when it surfaced again, it was persecuted. People had to make great sacrifices. It's not something that we should seek, but in everybody's life, usually on not the scale that Jesus and his disciples had to do it, but every one of us, every day, we have sacrifice after sacrifice after sacrifice, isn't it so? If only in the effort toward self-realization, we sacrifice one desire for sake of a higher duty. We struggle against our inclination to give in to the ego and struggle to stand firm in the aspiration that we hold. And what we have to understand, and it is the key to everything, and it sounds cliche, but it has to be said, and there's no other way to say it. We are not alone in this effort. And it's very difficult, I believe, for us to fully understand how powerfully, in this moment, Jesus loves us. Every one of our masters, but we're speaking of Jesus. You know, he laid down his life for his friends, is how he said it. And just as Master says in his poem, I'll return again and again and again, even as long as one stray brother is left behind. The power of the Master is there. And some part of us thinks that we diminish him, or that he's too busy, or that I'm not really important, or I ought to be able to solve it myself. That is the voice of Satan whispering in your ear. Just think of yourself as if you were the mother of a child in need. And what if your child doesn't ask for your help because, Mommy, I thought you were too busy? It breaks your heart. Rather than being grateful for their consideration, you feel, how have I failed to communicate to you how completely I am here for you? Do you understand? This is what the masters are doing. They love us on a level that we will achieve, but in the meantime we can barely imagine. And their lives are fulfilled, their destiny are fulfilled when we receive. Greater can no love be than this, from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, from the festival of light, willingly to embrace limitation and death for the salvation of mankind. Ever and again, the masters reincarnate in human form for our salvation. We are so gifted and so blessed and have such very good karma to have a power like this, this power of the true power of Jesus, not the dogma, not the history, not the prejudice, but the friend. Just simply that, the friend, the best friend that you can ever have. You know, we have all these masters and we can hold them all, and then they can hold us, but only when we open ourselves to receive it.
Lord, I will be thine always. My Lord, I will be thine always. I may go far, farther than the stars. I may go far, farther than the stars, but I will be thine always. My Lord, I will be thine always. Devotees may come, devotees may go. Devotees may come, devotees may go, but I will be thine always. My Lord, I will be thine always. always. My Lord, I will be thine always. I may go far, farther than the stars. I may go far, farther than the stars, but I will be thine always. My Lord, I will be thine always. Devotees may come, devotees may go. Devotees may come, devotees may go, but I will be thine always. My Lord, I will be thine always. When I die, look into mine eyes. When I die, they will mutely say, I will be thine always. My Lord, I will be thine always. I may go far, farther than the stars. I may go far, farther than the stars, but I will be thine always. My Lord, I will be thine always. Devotees may come, devotees may go. Devotees may come, devotees may go. But I will be thine.
Main our friend. Long we feared to face your love, lest our emptiness it prove. Now at last our hearts we give you, who remain our friend, who remain our friend.
Very first one we put up, Babaji was the next, and we put him outside. We never built a house over him because it seemed appropriate not to. And in many of the stories about this path, it's always Babaji and Master that are the real driving force. And when Master was asked once why he did certain things in certain ways, his response was, "It's the way Babaji told me to do it," which in and of itself is extraordinary, because you think of Master having his own directed mission. But Babaji, as presented in Autobiography of a Yogi, is the avatar who helps avatars. They call him the Maha Avatar, the great avatar, who just exists in the Himalayas without... other masters are born for particular events. Jesus was born to set the West on a particular tract, to help those particular disciples at that particular time. And then he lives for a short period of time and then disappears from view. Krishna came to the transition between Kali Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, descending into Kali, to fight the great battle of Kurukshetra. Yogananda incarnated as William the Conqueror to help establish England and therefore by extension America and set the stage for all of this. But throughout it all, behind it all, Babaji has lived in the Himalayas, well known to a very small group of people. The shrine at Badrinath up in the mountains dedicated to Babaji has been there for many centuries, and of course Babaji has been known to a select few. But only very recently, with the publication of Autobiography of a Yogi, really, because Babaji told Master that it was time to reveal his existence really to anybody who wants to open that book. And it's a very interesting even just to contemplate that, both sides of it. The fact that he could be so instrumental in the direction of the whole planet and so completely unknown to almost everyone on the planet, and then a growing age of enlightenment comes, which is what Master's incarnation signals, so that now people can simply know, whatever that means to them and however they think about it, that Babaji is there. When we were just doing the kind of computer searching that you can do, we realized that one of the most searched names in the spiritual world is Babaji. And many people who read Autobiography of a Yogi forget everything in the book, but they remember Babaji because he has the power, because he captures the imagination, because so much of the book is about Babaji, in fact. Because, as Master said, Babaji told him to do it that way. Now, there's two remarkable stories that are in the autobiography that, thinking about the life of Jesus, I was struck by. And the two of them are, one, when Babaji is sitting around a large campfire, and they say for a Vedic ceremony. Even that very thought is interesting. Up in the mountains conducting some ritual, no doubt, for the benefit of the planet. And then Babaji picks up a burning piece of wood and he places it on the shoulder, on the bare shoulder of one of his the devotee's disciple sitting with him and just burns him horribly. I mean, they're all sitting together and he just picks it up and does it like that. And I think it was Keshabananda telling the story, saying, you know, how could you do that? And Babaji said, would you rather have seen him burn to ashes in front of your eyes according to his karma? He said, by doing this, I have mitigated his karma. And then Babaji reached out his hand and healed, you know, what was the horrible wound on the shoulder. Now, how many times in our lives do we feel that God has picked up a burning brand and just laid it on our bare shoulder? And our instinctive reaction to that is one of horror, isn't it? We shrink from it. Or we see, even more difficult, that God picks up a burning brand and lays it on the bare shoulder of someone we love, which in some ways is even harder. And our first inclination is to shrink from it, isn't it? The great challenge of this life is to take what we know philosophically and take it so deep into heart and spirit that whatever comes to us, we see that Babaji is holding the end of the stick, whatever it might be. And, well, Swami says, we will get it right eventually. Why waste a few million years? Why waste a few months of this incarnation, a few years of this incarnation, thinking on so many levels, why is this happening to me? Why is this happening? You know, what is it for? Would you rather be burned to ashes? Or would you be happy when the hand of God reaches down and moves us, even if painfully, forward toward where we're absolutely going to go? The other story is just the same, only the other story involves the deliberate decision of the disciple. And that story, which you all probably all well know, by great effort, some would-be disciple finds Babaji up in the mountains and comes to him and says, I found you, my master, here I am to be your disciple. And Babaji very coldly says, I'm not going to accept you. And the disciple declares with great emotion, picture the scene. You know, this is not a myth. This is an actual story. Here, this poor disciple, God knows who he was or where he came from or what he went through. Following Babaji, he said, for months in the mountains, he finally gets there. All the other disciples are sitting around too and think, oh, what a great honor that he's come, because he couldn't even find the camp if Babaji didn't let him. And Babaji says, no, like that. And then the disciple declares without hesitation, life is not worth living if I can't be your disciple. I would rather die. I will throw myself over the cliff. And so Babaji says, go ahead. And the way it's written, even in the autobiography, without any show of emotion, completely unemotionally, Babaji says, jump. So the disciple feels that his guru has given him instruction. This is what it is. And so he just runs to the cliff and throws himself off of it. Of course, all the other disciples are watching, and it seems horrid. But Babaji then sends them down to retrieve what is now the lifeless, mangled body of the disciple, and they bring him up, and then Babaji resurrects him, gives him his life back, and says, now you're ready. I mean, that is quite a story, right? How much is my life worth? Where does discipleship fit into my reality? How much faith do I have in God? How many other desires am I carrying? If, in fact, I was asked to throw myself off a cliff to prove my devotion, would I be able to? Would I even think of it? Would I even come close to the edge of that? Now, it's very unlikely that any of us will be tested so dramatically. But what we have to understand is twofold. God is always moving us, and the power of Babaji in the life of all those who are Kriyabans, all those who are disciples, all those who are open in any way to this ray of consciousness. In Autobiography of a Yogi, it says, whosoever says the name of Babaji with devotion. There is no other qualification there. Just says the name of Babaji with devotion, will attract to himself or herself an instant blessing. Now, is that blessing going to be the burning brand applied to our shoulder, or is it going to be the healing touch that comes after? You know? We ourselves are so busy thinking about what we like and what we don't like. It's very difficult not to live that way. We are so deeply programmed and so habituated to dividing the world up into what we enjoy and what we don't enjoy, and dividing the world up into those things that we think will help us and those things we think won't. It's everything on the spiritual path, moment by moment, to recognize that Babaji is always holding the other end of that stick. And even if we hurl ourselves off the cliff, rightly or wrongly, will always be there to lift us up and literally to resurrect us again. In this body, maybe. In another body, maybe. Who knows? There's that wonderful story of Shankaracharya where the disciple was so afraid of everything. The guru, Shankaracharya, and one of his disciples was so afraid of everything. She was always nervous, and he wanted her to do something, and she raised the question, "What if I die?" And he said, "Die then." And she did. Can you imagine? Now, of course, these things happen. I mean, this could happen in a gathering like this if such a person were with us, just right in front. "Die then." And so she fell over dead. Then that was that. And he did not resurrect her, at least according to this story. But what I love about that story is, of course, the guru's consciousness just went with her. And what I love is the part that isn't told, which is him saying to her, "Well, how did that work for you?" Because that had to have been there. That had to have been there. He would never have tested a disciple like that, given her such a challenge, and then abandoned her. The guru never abandons you. So everything that comes to us, we have to think, Babaji is always in charge. He's in charge of us. If we could see, and by the grace of God, sometimes at least we can intuit. Swamiji characterized the consciousness of Babaji. It was very interesting. He characterized it as joy. And I really love thinking of it that way. Because you see, what Babaji has is this perspective of this long evolution, both of planetary and cosmic consciousness, and of all of our individual consciousness. Babaji has held his body through all. How many incarnations have we had? I mean, we don't know how many. How long ago did we finally discover this path and become disciples? Babaji has been with all of us every step of that way. In Autobiography of a Yogi, it says, if you just think of Babaji with devotion, then you will attract his blessing. And if we have done Kriya, if we have prayed to him, if we have sacrificed in any way, if we have served his work, I mean, that's more and more and more. Babaji is walking with each one of us. We have to contemplate what omnipresence means. He doesn't have a limit. Just because he's with me doesn't mean he can't also be with you and you and you and you. That beautiful story of Krishna where the gopis go out to dance, and every gopi has Krishna for a partner. And everyone thinks they're alone with Krishna, because we are. And Babaji is watching each one of us, especially each one of us, because we chose to incarnate at a time to carry on his mission. You know, many of you who are here, and many of you have heard, when Swamiji dedicated this community, you know, right standing a few yards from here in 1989, he made the simple statement, Babaji is very pleased with this. With this place, right here, the land we're sitting on, Babaji is very pleased, because communities established, especially in an environment like this, where so much is going toward materialism, and yet all of us are also finding this way to be self-realizationists and Kriyabans and disciples, and to say with devotion the name of Babaji, and to build a shrine to his presence right here, this is why Babaji exists. And this is why we incarnated. And if we say his name with devotion, then we tract ourselves to ourselves an instant blessing. And the joy that Babaji feels is very simple, because he knows the end of the story. You know, I when I go to a movie, I like to know that it's going to end happily. I don't like to go for tragedy. When Swami would buy novels to read on an airplane or something like that, he would always go to the back of the book and then read the last chapter. I would say, why do you do that? He said, I don't want to read a story that doesn't end happily, he said. There's too much grief in my life. I don't need it when I'm on an airplane. I said, doesn't it spoil it? He said, no, as a writer, I'm intrigued to see how he gets there. But just that simple thought of the happy ending. You know, in the speed with which Babaji accelerated people's karma, he burned the arm and fixed it. The disciple sacrificed his life and Babaji resurrected him. It happened like that. But time is not an issue. Babaji knows that sooner or later we're going to get it right. And not just right, like we'll have a good incarnation. Absolutely, eternally, infinitely, blissfully right forever. And when he looks at us, he doesn't see all of this that we're struggling with and thinking about all the time. He just sees the happy ending. And that joy, that's what that joy is based on. That joy is based on the fact that bliss is the end of the whole story. Everything will end in bliss. Now, there might be a little bit of fire in between. But the masters have been through it. And they also understand that. You know, as Master said in his prayer, I will weep through my eyes and perchance also through yours. So it isn't as if they're only standing with us when we're courageous and good. You know, when we have lost all hope and all possibility even of holding our heads up and are in those states of despair and confusion which come to everyone. You know, even then, when our mangled body is lying on those rocks, even in that moment, Babaji is sending his disciples down to pick us up and carry us back to be resurrected. It's not an easy path, but it's very simple. And Jesus with Babaji are walking that path with us.
Yet as vast as are their numbers, so many years I wandered far from you. Through many lives, I've drunk the cup of sorrow. No man could tell the bitter tears I've shed. The drops in the endless sea, if one could count, would come to billions. Yet as vast as are their numbers, so many years I wandered far from you. Yet as vast as are their numbers, so many years I wandered far from you. Through countless lives, I've sought your cup of sweetness, found other cups, but thirsted evermore. The streams in the hills of time all found their way into a desert. Every noon of bright fulfillment, ere many hours did sink to evening gloom. Every noon of bright fulfillment, ere many hours did sink to evening gloom. I long for you in summer and in winter, only for you my heart this day and night. I've known that the sweetest songs ears ever heard were but your echo. Lord, at last fill me completely, for nevermore I'd wander far from you. Lord, at last fill me completely, for nevermore I'd wander far from you.
One of the places, I don't remember the source now, Swami Kriyananda characterized Master's mission as having five characteristics, which are really beautiful to contemplate. The first is to show that spirituality is equally available to both monastics and to householders, whereas in Kali Yuga there was this thought that you either lived in the world or you lived for God. What's happening now is the idea that wherever you are, you can make it spiritual. And when Swamiji commented about the power of this community as an example, he said, if we can make it work here, in this environment, it proves that spirituality can be anywhere. It also, if we can show people that they don't have to repudiate the life that they're accustomed to, but can add to it a spiritual dimension, will have really brought a new understanding. So that spirituality is for monastics and householders. The second, Swami said, is education for children. Because if we're ever going to transform society, we have to start raising children in a completely different way. As long as generations are brought up with the same distorted values that we see in our society now, there will be no vehicle for them to shift their consciousness. The third characteristic was art as inspiration, not entertainment. Creativity as sadhana. In other words, overcoming the ego by transmuting it to a higher level, rather than merely taking everything that we are and suppressing it by so self-realization through self-expression, but on a higher octave. The fourth was that truth is joyous and not merely a continual protest against injustice. Now, isn't that an interesting way to put it? And then the fifth is, we live a life of service rather than self-aggrandizement. That we're thinking always, what can I give, not what can I get. Now, Lahiri Mahashaya was the beginning of this teaching coming out of the Himalayas. We had Autobiography of a Yogi, where Master told people about Babaji. But before he told people about Babaji, back in the 1800s, the late 1800s, Lahiri Mahashaya, at Babaji's call, returned to his guru, was initiated into Kriya, and then in autobiography this beautiful grace was offered. Babaji says, give this Kriya to those who are willing to renounce everything in the search for God. Lahiri Mahashaya essentially said, I guess I won't be very busy initiating people. And he said to Babaji, very few can meet that standard. He said, but if they had Kriya, then they would be able to rise to it. And so, as it's poetically told in autobiography, Babaji says, the divine through you has spoken. But then what happened is, Lahiri goes back, because he was 33 when this happens, and he goes back to Varanasi, and for the next 25 years, he continues his career as a government accountant. And he does nothing to announce what has happened. He just begins to live according to the awakened reality that Babaji has given. Of course, Lahiri was an avatar. People explain this in all different ways, that he really didn't really come into his incarnation until after he was initiated. However, this is how it was acted out. And he lived as simple, as plain, and as unobtrusive a life as you can imagine. He worked for the British. He was an accountant. He had children. His wife, he lived in this small, relatively speaking, house way back in the old part of Varanasi. Some of you have been to that house. Some of you have been with us to that house and seen where he lived. And he just carried on. And he began to prove that spirituality is not just for monastics, it's for householders. And in his spare time, he started a high school. And he also worked as a tutor. He worked for education. He was not so much involved in the creative arts, but he was showing also the truth is joyous. He wasn't protesting against anything. He wasn't even campaigning for Kriya. He was simply radiating the truth of what Babaji had given to him and what he himself was drawing from the infinite and expressing through his own nature. Now, we all tend to think that change takes place in the way that the world imagines that change takes place. The life of Christ and his disciples should be sufficient to alert us that we're thinking of it backwards. No one who was a contemporary of Christ would ever have imagined, except those who were his disciples, the impact that his life would have. But everything else about that time only has relevance if it touched the lives of a Christ. The rest of it has been forgotten. And it was several centuries after the life of Jesus, before Christianity began to assume its world-influencing position. But with that power of the masters, they're not working with human time. They're working with this gradual building up of power until that power becomes irresistible. And so Lahiri represents for us the essential nature of the spiritual path. It was integrated into ordinary life. It was concerned about the welfare of others through education, which mattered. And it was supremely joyous, because he knew inside himself that if he could give to others this single key of understanding, change your consciousness and everything in creation will be different. He told people, you know, in response to every situation, practice Kriya. Swamiji balanced that out by saying he didn't have to tell people to love God because they already did. He didn't have to tell people to see their lives in a spiritual context because they already did. What he was giving them was how to combine devotion with self-effort. And that is also the key to our path, devotion with self-effort, and then that fifth quality, how can I serve? That life is for service, not for self-aggrandizement. You know, Lahiri was very humble when he retired from his job, and after 25 years, he spent the last 9 years of his life just sitting in his room, in the living room, meditating, not sleeping, just meditating while the disciples came. And in the autobiography, it tells the story. His wife becomes alarmed. And she says to him, you know, what's going to happen to us? What's going to happen to your children? You should be doing something to take care of us. And you remember, the hearer's response was to disappear. He just dematerialized. I mean, that would be a technique that husbands and wives could use if they had it. When your wife or your husband says something you're not fond of, if you could just dematerialize, that's a conversation stopper, isn't it? And it did. Completely stopped her. And he rematerialized on the ceiling. And then his voice rang out, "How can a nothing like me provide for a nothing like you?" You know? All of this play. He said, "Don't worry." He said, "One of my disciples will provide." And in fact, that's exactly what happened. But there was much more behind that. Leary knew very simply, my life is for service, not for self-aggrandizement. It's a very important principle to realize. Even our lives are not the search for enlightenment. Swamiji says elsewhere, rather than pray even for enlightenment, he said, pray to be in tune. It's a very interesting statement. Because if we're in tune with the divine flow, then everything else will follow. And even the desire to be enlightened can so easily slip over into self-concern. But the desire to serve will always put us in the flow of the masters. Here then is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey. And Lahiri, he says, you know, he meets Babaji in the Himalayas. Babaji has kept his brass water pot polished and his blanket neatly folded. Lahiri's natural inclination, as expressed in the book, is that, well, now that I've found you, forget the government office, the wife, the children, the house, all of those things. I'm just going to go back to my cave and live this life. And Babaji says, no, not actually. You get to go back and live life just as you've been doing it. But now everything is for serving. And the way Master described it is the fragrance of the flower of devotion and of Kriya Yoga just emanated from him. Did he ever think of himself? Did he ever think of his position? No. He just thought, my guru has commissioned me to meditate and to initiate others and to share this understanding that I have. Swamiji says, if we strive to be in tune, then what happens is we begin to feel that we're walking along a thread. I saw, many of you were at the Portland Yoga Fest a few weeks ago. I wasn't present, but I saw one of the things that happened out in the public square. And there was this long rope, and everybody was holding onto the rope, and people were chanting. It was sort of a game that they were playing. Several people looked like they were pretty deep in the spine while they were doing it. Deep in the spine is a way of saying, I'm just mortified, but I'll just keep doing this. But I loved the image of it. I love the image of listening to the melody and holding onto the rope and just following wherever that rope goes. I mean, that's what the exercise was. Somebody was in charge and they were snaking around, and all you did was just hold on to the rope and listen to the music like this. Wouldn't it be simple if that's how we could just see our lives? Just hold on to the rope. But our job is to get a hold of that rope. And that rope, it's not really that hard to find if we're sincere in asking for it. Lahiri Mahashaya manifested the interior life. He kept extensive diaries, which have not been published, all about his inner experiences. I think it's going to be another century before they come out, because we have another job to do first. But in our kriya, in our devotion, in our practice, in our everyday life, just say, Master, show me the line. You know, put my hand on that rope, and then just pull me forward. And if we do that with enough sincerity, you begin to hear the melody. That's the only way I can say it. You begin to hear the Om somewhere in some part of you, so that if you step away from it, all of a sudden there's this feeling of dissonance, and you have to go back and you have to find it. And if we're living in that, it's like things still happen. It doesn't give you a pass on your karma, but it gives you a way to negotiate it. When I first found the spiritual path, and sometimes people have asked me this, well, you know, knowing Swamiji as I did all these years, it's a point of reference. It's a fixed point of reference in creation. The master's word for it is really simple, pole star. Someone asked me, you know, what's my relationship to Swami Kriyananda? I said, pole star. That says it even better than any other word, because the pole star is how you measure everything else that you do. And think what it means to have a pole star. Everything is possible then, if you have a pole star and you keep your eye on it. And then hold on to the line that comes like this. This is what Lahiri did. Babaji said back to Varanasi, meditate and initiate. And whenever our lives get too much for us, just be Lahiri Mahashaya. Just go to your government accountant job for 25 years and raise your children and then dematerialize if anybody criticizes you. If you can't do it physically, do it inwardly. I know what I am doing. I am here to serve. I'm not here for myself. And the spiritual path is joyous, 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 challenging at times, but underneath is the joy.
I have been roaming, forsaken by thee, who hast seen me groping, hardly ever answering. I shall be roaming, roaming, bursting all the boundaries of heart, evermore moving toward thee, to thy vast unthrobbing heart.
Come thou to me, O Lord, O come at last to me. Centuries and centuries I have waited now for thee. Through endless incarnations I've called out for thy name, searching by the streamlets of all my silvery dreams.
I know that thou must come at last to steal the flowers of my heart. In sorrow thrills I piped my love, I sadly sing my song to thee.
And yet I know my love must reach thee, though many lives I have to wait. On mountain crags of high devotion I sadly sing my song, my song, my song.
The one that people often think about is years in my master's hermitage, where we get the picture of Sri Yukteswar as the stern taskmaster, and all that Master and the other disciples had to do in order to live up to his high expectations for them. The other chapter is the resurrection of Sri Yukteswar, in which, after his passing, he appears to Master in a hotel room in Mumbai, in Bombay, and tells Master all about the astral, the high astral world that he has now been resurrected on. And you know, whenever you read autobiography of a yogi, you notice different things at different times. And the part that really struck me when I was reading it this time was Master writing about how Sri Yukteswar said that those high astral beings are constantly helping us. And it just, it was a really interesting thought to realize how little we're conscious of the forces that are acting upon this world. When my friend Paula was in the last days of her life, in my book about Swami's life, the Swami Kriyananda, as we've known him, there's a chapter about her passing, which was really quite conscious and extraordinary. And in the last, there was about what we called 3 days of Paula's passing party. And somewhere in the second or third day, she had a conversation on the phone with Swamiji. And I think he must have been away, because that was why she was on the phone with him. And she said, she had a very childlike way of speaking. She said, "I hope they have a job for me up there in the astral world." She said, "You know how I like to be busy," just like that. And Swamiji said, "Yes, of course, Paul, they're going to have a place for you." And years later, when my mother passed away, I was out of the country, as it happened, and I was in Rome with Swami. And I was asking him, you know, "Where is my mother now? What is she conscious of?" And in a very kind way, but specifically, he said, "I think that at her level of consciousness," is how he put it, and she was a good woman, but she wasn't spiritually inclined, "she remembers this world, but only vaguely. She's not really conscious of this world." I sort of wanted to know what my responsibility was to her now that she had passed out of that body. That was my specific question. Do I need to keep a continuing relationship with her, or can I just let her go? Will she be hurt if I just let it go? That was really my question. He said, "She's only vaguely conscious of this world. The details are not clear to her." But then I remarked, I said, "But after Paula died, Swamiji, I felt like she was watching me all the time." And he said, "Oh, yes, of course." Just like that. "Yes, of course." And in another context, Swami and I were talking about dreams people have of him, for example, coming to them and giving them advice. And Swami remarked to me that he even if he wasn't conscious of it, the advice that he gave them was always the advice he wanted to give them. And I said, "Did they listen to you?" And then I said, "Only in your dreams." But the point is, and this is how Swami explained, because I was asking about the phenomenon of dreams. He said, if we have recognized that it is our responsibility in this world to help other people, that becomes our essential vibration. I mean, if it is our essential vibration, if we're doing it to be important or to impress others, or if it's hypocritical, then that's different. But if our essential vibration, if we've watched the pole star and have got a hold of the rope and realized that when we're helping others, we're in the light, and when we think about ourselves, we move out of the light. That's the fifth characteristic of this mission, service to others rather than service to self. Then it becomes our essential vibration. Life, death, astral world, causal world, material world, sleep or wakefulness has no effect on it. It's just our essential vibration. Paula says, "You know how I like to be busy." Master Swami said, "Of course they'll have a job for you." Sri Yukteswar talks about Hiranyaloka, and we have this idea that at some point it becomes different. But what we have to realize, we have to think about it from a different angle. What we are now descends from a higher level. And so everything that we're experiencing here is a reflection of the more and more subtle realms. And when we look at the most advanced consciousness that we can imagine, which is the Self-Realized Masters, which is what we're celebrating tonight, what is their essential vibration? How can I serve? Everything about their lives is just there to serve. Even Sri Yukteswar, who lived more quietly and didn't have many disciples, only a few stragglers is how he put it, but he incarnated to train master, and in training master, he reached millions, beyond millions. Autobiography of a Yogi is the most influential spiritual book on the planet. Any gathering where people are beginning to awaken, and you ask them, how many have read Autobiography of a Yogi? Almost everyone. How many of you, your life was completely set in a new direction by Autobiography of a Yogi? Almost everyone. So Sri Yukteswar did one thing. He trained master, and then master went out to change the world. But then he goes to Hiranyaloka, where he says, people are more able to meet my high standards than they are on the material plane, which is the vibration, the subtle vibration that he's working with is more compatible with souls on that level. But then he says that they are focused on this world and they are helping us. There was one beautiful after death and return story from this one man, and he said when he left his body and moved into the non-physical world, this is what he described. He said he was standing in a stadium with thousands of places in it, and he was on the field, like at a big football stadium or a big concert. He was in the center of the field. The entire stadium was filled with beings of light. And this is the part I loved. And they were all cheering for him. Can you imagine? He said they were all cheering for him. Now, I think this is a true representation of what it really is. And it's not just because we are disciples, but that certainly puts us in a certain alignment. If you're a devotee of the spiritual path, it puts you in a greater alignment for one very simple reason. It makes you more open. The more open we are, the more we can magnetize, and the higher vibrations that we can magnetize. But all beings, everybody is helping somebody. You know, you're turning to the one who's receptive to what you have to offer. Even if it's a con artist training his apprentice, he's still passing it on what he knows. And even though it's not a very high level of understanding, he's passing it on. So Sri Yukteswar tells us that when he left this world, he continues to exist on Hiranyaloka. And Swami, Master, just tells us the most wonderful story. And the other part of that story about Sri Yukteswar, which is so touching, is the depth of Master's affection for his guru. And Master's capacity for love, and his capacity for gratitude. And he's also illustrating to us what it is that we're supposed to feel, what it looks like to be a disciple. In our incarnation, the example of what it looks like to be a disciple has been mostly offered to us by Swami Kriyananda. But in Autobiography of a Yogi, Master himself shows us what it looks like to be a disciple. And he tells us about Sri Yukteswar when he manifested in the hotel room. All of this, you know, is told for effect, but it's also true. And Master says that his habitual response when he first met his guru was to fall at his feet. But this time he just grabbed him in a hug like that. Now, imagine, you know, the absence. His master's been taken away from him. And however Master was experiencing that, he delayed his return to America, he canceled his plans, and he just talked about just having to realize that that whole divine lila was now done. When Swami Kriyananda was asked once in a public satsang, a small satsang, how did it feel? How did you feel when Master died? Bear in mind, Swami was not quite 26. He had been with Master for just over 3 years. He anticipated going to India with Master. His whole spiritual life was just beginning. And then, completely without any expectation, in front of his eyes, Master falls over and is gone. So someone asked Swami, how did you feel? Swami's first response was very sober. That's a very personal question, he said like that. And everyone was silent. And then Swami sort of gathered himself, and he said very simply, it was heartbreaking. Now, it's important for us to hear something like that. And it's important that Master put his story of Sri Yukteswar into the autobiography of a yogi, where he tells us how much he mourned the loss of his guru and how joyously and spontaneous, with such affection, he greeted him when he came to visit. Because it's that freedom of heart, above all, which really characterizes the devotee. You know, we're so calculated in our responses. We're so concerned about this and about that and about doing the right thing and appearing in the right way. But blessed are the pure in heart. Suffer little children to come unto me. That's what the masters tell us. That which is the most natural to us, what it is that we're trying to take away, is all this facade of having our lives together and knowing what we're doing and all of this. And it just all comes down to the simplest relationship of guru and disciple, of devotee and God, with humility, with simplicity, with childlike devotion, with absolute authenticity. And it's all the more touching because of the way that Sri Yukteswar's personality is described by Master. You know, so austere, and how, you know, Master had to plead with Sri Yukteswar for a word of reassurance when he comes back. And very reluctantly, Sri Yukteswar objects to taking feelings that are so deep and having to bring them out into the light of day. But his disciple demands it of him, and so Sri Yukteswar speaks. He said, I always wish that I could have a son, and that I could give to my son what I have realized, and you are that son to me. And Master talked about what that meant to him, to have his guru affirm his reality like that. Swami tells us that just in the last days of Master's life, Master said to him, you have pleased me very much. I want you to know that. You know, this is the one enduring relationship. And this is why Master writes about it so powerfully. And you have the Lahiri Mahashaya meeting Babaji, and Babaji has folded up his blanket and kept his water pot polished. And Master writes about, what kind of a lover can maintain the tie, not merely from the beginning to the end of one incarnation, which is sufficient challenge, but between incarnations, never losing that. And more than that, always holding up, pulling that disciple upward and upward and upward, and then gathering a host of angels and guiding a host of angels, a stadium full of astral beings, all cheering for us. You know, this is where this whole idea of the spiritual path as joy really comes from. The Curidar, the French priest, if you knew how much God loves you, you would die for joy. Just think about that. And it begins with gratitude. It begins with appreciating what we have. It begins with understanding what we have. You know, beings whose capacity for loyalty and love so far transcends what we can imagine, that it's beyond imagination of expectancy. but it's there. And to whatever little tiny bit we can open our hearts and our awareness to it, it floods into us. The masters, if we knew how much they loved us, we would die for joy. In the midst of anything that comes, always come back to that single fact. I love God, and God returns my love. I love the Master, and the Master returns my love. And their commitment to me far transcends anything I can do to try to break it. And my commitment to them far transcends anything I do to try to break it. It is who I am. It is the breath that I breathe. It is the life force within me.
I've passed my life as a stranger, Lord, roamed far in foreign lands, far, Lord, far, too far. Only he who knows he's far from home, only he, Lord, understands. Only he who knows he's far from home feels the earth and understands. Sometimes a stranger did take me in, then love I thought was near. Love, Lord, where is love? Like the wind upon the desert sand, whisper hope, then disappear. Like soft winds breathe on the desert sands, so love sighs, then disappears. Sometimes a child laughed, and I did pause, and dreamed of joys at home. Joys, Lord, only a dream. For what joy is there without your smile? Empty like the ocean foam. For what joy is there without your smile? You're the sea, all else is foam. How long must I be a wanderer, Lord? You know where I belong. You know, Lord, yes, you know. Home is where my Lord's sweet presence is. I've grown tired of stranger songs. Home is where my Lord's sweet presence is. Bless me that I hear your song.
The story of Swami Kriyananda finding Master. Being in New York City and coming across Autobiography of a Yogi, This is in 1948. The book was only published in 1946. And he was 22 years old and very much having already exhausted the obvious options for his life. And he really didn't know what he was going to do or how he was going to go forward. And he came across Autobiography of a Yogi. Master, of course, was living then in Los Angeles. And Swamiji said he, over the next 3 days, practically day and night, he read Autobiography of a Yogi and was utterly transformed by the experience. And as he said, not wanting to be impulsive, he waited a day and then got on a bus for Los Angeles, crossing the country. And the first words he spoke to Master were, "I want to be your disciple." Swami told that story many, many times, especially toward the last years of Swami's life. Almost every time he would get up and speak, he would tell us about finding Autobiography, what it meant to him going across the country, becoming Master's disciple. Sometimes that story would be interrupted because he would be so overcome with emotion that he would have to pause and master himself, and often he was unable to, and he would just weep, which for him was, in the last years of his life, was common. But prior to that, he kept his spiritual feeling very private. At the end of his life, he was simply not able to anymore, and it broke through on many occasions. By the end of his life, after 60 plus years of discipleship, he just couldn't think of anything to talk about except having met Master and what that meant to him. Now, he died in his, like, he was 85 or so when he died. He was 22 when he met Master. During all those years in between, you know, an enormous number of things happened. Just the sheer magnitude of his creative output was breathtaking. What to speak of the many obstacles he encountered and the challenges he had to overcome, everything. But for the last years of his life, over and over again, all he could think of to talk about was, "I found Autobiography, I went to Master, he accepted me as a disciple, he gave me his unconditional love, and I gave him my unconditional love." Now, there's a lesson there that we really need to pay attention to, which is everything else matters. It matters because in the effort to achieve, we overcome our limitations. And in the effort to achieve, we learn to love one another, to work with one another. And some of the work that we do will carry on and have some benefit. But what will really benefit is who we become from that effort. And what we become is the grace of God. I mean, the result of our efforts is not because of our efforts. It's because in trying our hardest to align ourselves with a higher reality, we do. And we align ourselves with something that just comes into us and makes us something else. And just as I was speaking a moment ago about Master's dedication to his guru, Swamiji's entire life, just from the beginning to the end, was one long, dedicated effort of devotion to his guru. Swamiji said one of the reasons he was so immediately magnetized to Autobiography of a Yogi, I found this in the notes that I had. I'd never remembered hearing him say it, but I must have because I wrote it down. But he said, ever since I was a child, ever since I was born, he said, "I always felt that I existed in a world of my own that no one around me could share." Swamiji talked about how at the age of 9, he gradually began to realize how how alien this world was to him. He said it began when he began to realize how deeply he differed from his father in his own worldview. His father was a good man, but his father just saw the world so differently. He began to reach an age where he realized that he was solitary in his perceptions, and a great deal of anguish began at that age that lasted until he met Master. Because Swamiji said, when I read Autobiography of a Yogi, he said, I realized that Master and I existed in the same world. Isn't that a beautiful way to put it? I think all of us who find ourselves on the spiritual path, and even after we get on the spiritual path, there is a certain solitude to the human consciousness. And that really is the burden of human consciousness, isn't it? We try very hard to make alliances and friendships, and those friendships that are based in divine aspiration have an eternal quality to it. Swamiji made the comment, he said, after we're gone, all the work that we do will gradually be forgotten, but the relationships that we form, and he said, whether harmonious or disharmonious, will go on forever. It's a very sobering thought, isn't it? In another context, Swamiji had a misunderstanding with some very close friends, and he wrote this letter, and he said, everything I have done for Master and all that I have accomplished for Ananda, he said, would be meaningless if in doing so I lost the friendship of you and people like you. And Swamiji often commented, quoting from Master, that the highest kind of discipleship is the relation of friendship. And we may think that would be less in some way, but Master said for this reason, he said, friendship is the only relationship that is entirely free, that is not coerced by any sense of responsibility. Even mother love, which can be the most self-sacrificing, is nonetheless compelled. But friendship is given out of our own free will. And Swamiji often talked about how what Master gave us was friendship in God, where by our own choice and by our own free will, we align ourselves out of our shared dedication to God. And Swamiji also talked once about a certain dream that he had, in which various things that were very important were told to him, but the message of the dream in this instance is less important than how he described it. He said, in that dream, Master and I were two friends together, he said, working for a common cause. He said, when I was with Master in the body, Swamiji said he was so much younger. And so new on the path, and Master was so advanced in his years and so at the end of his mission. I asked Swamiji once when I said something rather cheeky, just teasing him in some way or another, and I suddenly wondered if I was behaving in a terribly inappropriate manner. And I said, Swamiji, did you ever tease Master? And he said, oh no, he said, I was much too in awe of him. I never could have done that. He said, but Dr. Lewis did, because he and Dr. Lewis had met in their 20s. They were young men together. They grew up together. He had a kind of freedom with Master that Swamiji said he never had. Swami actually said later in his life, when he spent time with Anandamoyi Ma, he said, I had with Anandamoyi Ma the kind of relationship I was too young to have ever had with Master. So Swami said, in this dream, though, suddenly he was standing side by side, shoulder to shoulder with Master, the two of them dedicated to the cause of self-realization and Babaji's mission to uplift the planet and to bring us into Dwapara Yuga. And so it was only incidental when Swamiji recited the dream, but you could tell also how deeply gratifying it was for him, because what it meant was that he had fulfilled his master's commission to him. Swamiji was given this unique responsibility. Master told him repeatedly, you have a great work to do. And after Swami died, Rajasi said to him, you have a great work to do and Master will give you the strength to do it. So what this is about, because Swamiji is our example of what it means to be a disciple, in the life of Jesus, Jesus says to his disciples toward the end of his life, he says, you call me master, but I call you friend. He said, a servant will serve his master, but he never embraces his master's cause as his own. He said, a friend, that which is of value to one friend is of equal value to another. And when Master says to us that the highest kind of discipleship is also friendship, it also has to do with the dignity and the responsibility that comes with being a disciple. We ask ourselves, how can we be in tune? And we speak of, and I spoke of it earlier, more even than enlightenment, we should seek to be in tune. Because if we are in tune with the vibration of the Master, then everything else will follow from that. But to be in tune with the vibration of the Master is to be a friend, to value what that friend values. And all of our masters came to serve. This is the unique quality of our particular path. There are other paths in which the disciple is guided to leave behind everything about this world. Just put it out of your mind. Go to the mountains, go to the cave. And even on this path, there are those who would be called that way. But those of us who belong to Swami have followed a different path. We have picked up where Master left off, and we are picking up where Swami left off. This is far from done. This is a war on the causal plane. Swamiji said that so many different times. This is a war of ideas on the causal plane. We are establishing a beachhead for the cause of self-realization and planting that vibration as powerfully as we can plant it so that all those who feel they live in a world that no one else understands will read Autobiography of a Yogi or come to Ananda or hear about Swamiji and suddenly understand, I am not alone. I'm sure all of you have had both sides of that experience. And even on the spiritual path, we have to fill our hearts with the love of God and the love of one another, for one another and from one another, fills in around that. But it all has its power from being the love of God. That's what our path is. But then that love made active. Swami described bliss as love in action. It's a very interesting way to put it, isn't it? And he said, especially toward the end of his life, he said, all that I've done, he said, I know it's of value. I know it's helped bring people to the path. He said, but sharing the bliss of God, he said, that's really everything. And Swami writes another aspect about Master's living legacy. He said the Master's writings, the places where he lived, the organizations he founded, he said they can inspire. But the power of the Master, he said, is transferred by living disciples. Because living disciples can attune themselves to the Master's presence, and then they can give that to others. He said whole institutions can become corrupt. You know, and then even if they act in the name of God and Gurus, the power of God and Guru isn't there. The vibrations of the Master can be in the building, can be on the grounds. He said, but the living presence, that's where the guidance comes from. That's how Swami put it. Not just the inspiration, but the guidance. And that is our single responsibility, to become living extensions of Master. And it's not a matter of pride to think of ourselves that way. In fact, it's just the opposite. Who am I but a living extension of my Master? What does my life matter? Over and over again, Swamiji would say that to us. Someone said, "Of what accomplishment are you the most proud?" His response was, "I don't feel like I've accomplished anything." And he wasn't being foolish. He knew how many books he'd published. But he felt that God had accomplished everything. And if God has accomplished it, where is the place for pride? But then after a moment, he corrected himself slightly. He said, "If I'm proud of anything, it's this," he said. "I am the disciple of a great master." And then he said, "But pride isn't quite the right word. The word for that is absolute gratitude." And how do we express gratitude? How do you express love for a friend? You act in such a way that your actions correspond to the needs and desires of your friend. You take upon yourself the carrying on of their own life mission. These are of the five characteristics of Master's work. How will others know unless we ourselves exemplify it? And what is more useful to this planet and ultimately more fulfilling that for us than to say so simply, "I am the disciple of a great master, and my life is dedicated to being his living instrument."